The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect introduces Tim Cormode, the Executive Director of Power to Be in Victoria, BC. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah. How did you get involved in this? What is it? First of all, what is it so that people know what we're talking about?
Yeah, Power to Be is a charity, a non-for-profit out here in Victoria, British Columbia. And we provide outdoor education programs for families and youth, primarily living with a disability. And our outreach is sort of Vancouver Island and the lower mainland of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. We've been in operation now for 14 years, coming on to our 15th anniversary next year. So it's a bit of a wonderful turn for us, and that's what we do.
Good. How did you get involved in it?
I'm originally actually from Toronto, or north of Toronto, a small town called Orillia.
Yeah.
When I was a young lad, I guess in my days, back when I was 15, my first summer job was working. I don't know if you may or may recall, but there used to be a big sort of center in Orillia called the Huronia Regional Center.
Okay.
And it was an institution for people with disabilities. Obviously, that's changed a lot in the last 20 years as people have become more brought into the community, which I think is obviously a very solid move. But back in the days, it was an institution, and I worked in a summer job there, and I really, really liked working with people with special needs. I just sort of really enjoyed it, and it kind of took me to university to get help. When I was in the University of Western, I had a job there working in a group home. And when I moved out west in 94 after graduating, and was looking for potentially upgrading my marks at university here and also for work. And I ended up getting a job working as a youth care worker at a hospital here locally. Mm-hmm. And it was great for a couple of years. And I think in my late 20s, started to wonder what I was doing in my life as far as it was just going to be a career for me or not. And I decided I needed to sort of a change of atmosphere, and so I took a leave of absence from work, and I actually went to Canmore, Alberta, and I took part in a three-month outdoor leadership program. And back in the days when I was a kid, I used to do a lot of canoeing with my dad up in Algonquin Park. And
all right.
I guess you can say I kind of disconnected to the nature roots of my life through my university years. And
yeah.
I went and took this course, and it was sort of 12 people who I did not know, and we were all involved in a variety of outdoor activities and living in tents together and just learning to live with each other and enjoy the outdoors. And I just remember one day we'd climbed a mountain, and I was sitting up there on my own and just reflecting, and I thought, how cool would it be for the kids and adults that I've worked with in the past to have such an opportunity like this. So Power to Be, the idea was born on a mountain. And,
wow.
And since then, I came home and back to Victoria, and I did some homework, and I realized, this is 15 years ago. There wasn't a lot of these opportunities out for people with disabilities at the time, and I went down to the States and volunteered for a really well-known organization that provided a lot of really great outdoor education programs. And I went down there for 2 weeks, and it changed my life. And at that point, I knew what I wanted to do, and that was to start Power to Be and create what we have today.
Wow. What a story.
Bit of a long story.
Yeah, what a story. When you said you enjoyed working with disabled people, what did you enjoy?
Oh, there's a lot of things. First of all, I think, you know, my dad's a doctor, retired now. My mom's a retired physiotherapist. So I think partly I was born into sort of the idea of giving back in the health sector. And okay. I obviously wasn't going to be a doctor. I wasn't going to be a physiotherapist. So this was my way of giving back. And so I think I just, it was just this natural sort of ability that I really wanted to do this. And I think what I really enjoyed about it was just the fact that it was natural to me. I could, you know, I think respect and relate and try to support each individual that I worked with based on what their needs were. And it didn't come from education. I think it came from experience. And so I really just, I think that's what I enjoy. I enjoy working with people when they start to, you know, I really enjoy getting to encourage them to sort of see what their abilities are versus their disabilities.
Oh, yeah.
It's something that's very important to me. And I think our programs really do that. It's all about not focusing on what you can't do, but what you can do. And
good idea.
I mean, that applies to everybody right across the board. But, you know, I just think sometimes some of these individuals we work with, to give you an example, you know, when say, you know, some of the brain injury, you know, they could have been, you know, maybe in a car accident and they were able-bodied before and now they're disabled. And I think that's its own challenge in itself versus being born with a disability where you learn, you know, from day one on how to adapt versus those that are years later, it's a completely different life for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you really try to inspire, and I just knew I was something good at and I liked it. So that's why I do it.
Wow. Now, you've been going for 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
How have you grown to the size that you've grown? I mean, how did you get started? Was it your own money?
Yeah, well, that's another long story. But, I mean, not long story short is the answer is we started out, you know, it was myself and a friend of mine, a business partner of mine, and we both, you know, shared the same idea that we really wanted to do this, and we love the outdoors. So, you know, when we first started out, we had a target market where we were really marketing our services to individuals with insurance claims who'd been in motor vehicle accidents, where an occupational therapist was looking for referring some outdoor or recreation outlets for these individuals, and we were basically hired to do so.
Okay.
And that market was saturated very quickly, and we realized, you know, that we weren't in it to make money, and we realized in order to, and also the individuals we work with didn't have any money. So the idea was we really needed to create a non-for-profit organization, and with the help of a good friend, actually, sort of our first donor out of Aurelia, he sort of suggested to us, because I had phoned him back at home, and he had suggested, you know, that he had some contacts with the federal government.
Oh, yeah.
With the Minister of Physical Health and Recreation at the time. And so really what we did is we applied for a charitable status, and he sort of helped pass it through the minister, you know, the federal ministers at the time, who helped us kind of just get our charitable status on top of the, you know, on top of the pile. I'm not saying that's the legit way to go. We were just lucky that way. And,
yeah,
within about 2 weeks, we had our charitable status, and this individual was kind enough to make it our first donation of $10,000. And from there, we started, obviously, we needed to change our business model, and it was more along the lines of, you know, we need to raise money to support this organization. We're not going to be charging for our services. And so, you know, that's kind of, I guess, how it got started, and now, you know, 14 years later, we're about, our goal this year is $1.4 million. We raised about $1.2 last year, and that sort of served 500 families roughly last year in our organization. So,
all right.
And it's all privately funded. It's about 95% private sector and 5% government funding.
Yeah, that's a strength. So is it entirely without cost for the disabled clients?
Well, you know, it's one of those funny things. You know, we've talked strategically about this probably with our staff. We've gone back and forth on this for 2 or 3 years. You know, do we provide a completely free service? The answer is we don't turn anyone down for economic reasons or because of a disability. We do our best to adapt to their needs.
Okay.
We have found that the feedback from our participants comes in two different directions. One is, you know, if they have no money, we will obviously fund it. But by putting some sort of dollar amount, it's a very nominal fee. Let's just say, you know, a kayaking session might cost $100 for a 4-hour session. You know, I think it's $20 or something that we charge. The idea is that.
And what kind of session is that? A hiking?
Like going kayaking for, say,
four hours. Oh, kayaking,
kind of
okay.
Thing.
Yeah.
So just an example. But the idea is that we receive from our participants that they like the independence, and if they feel that they can pay for something, it's an independent thing for them to do versus feeling like it's a free service. Some people don't like the feeling of a free service. It's kind of like, you know, I don't need a free service. I have a disability, but I'm also very independent, and I can pay for this as well.
Yeah.
So we go back and forth. At the end of the day, we don't turn someone down because of economic means. Let's just put it that way.
Well, it sounds very healthy. I know from the experience with the show and even experience in my life, a lot of what's delivered free of charge to people with disabilities is dubbed a favor. And
absolutely.
And it affects its delivery, and it affects the success of the endeavor, too.
Yeah, and, you know, we're lucky in the sense that I think most of the participants we've served, I mean, some kind of cancel last minute, and they don't understand the value of that. But very rarely, I mean, I think people really, really like getting into our programs and being outside. There's a demand for that, so they're well aware that, you know, by missing those opportunities, it's good. It, you know, there's other people waiting for those opportunities, too. So, you know, it comes hand in hand.
You want to explain that a little more?
Sure. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is you know, we could... I think the people that take part in a program is really respect the fact that whether it's free or not, let's just say it's a free opportunity for them, you know, they don't take advantage of the situation. So they don't cancel last minute. We have an odd one that we do. But the problem is there's other people that want to be part of the program, and
right.
I think they realize that there's a demand here. And if you're given an opportunity, seize the opportunity, because if you don't, you're taking advantage of some other opportunity for somebody else who really wants to be part of the program.
Oh, good.
Because there's only so much that we can do, right? I mean, we obviously, if we were to put an ad in the paper tomorrow and just say free recreation services, our phones would be buzzing. Like, we just wouldn't be able to handle the demand.
Yeah.
And we have to be really careful about how we handle that. And how we handle it now is we really look more for partnerships in the community. So historically, or let's just say, I think in the last few years, and few of your listeners maybe who work in social service sector industries would probably understand this, and I mean, at least in BC, you know, due to government cutbacks, those basic programs, life skill development programs, those recreational arts programs, those really important things that just enhance quality of life are limited because of funding, you know, from government that maybe was much larger has really sort of become quite less.
Okay.
And because of that, you know, a lot of organizations that used to provide those services can't. So we come in and say, look, we'd love to work with you, and we'll collaborate with this community living association, and we'll provide the recreation services at no cost, and we'll raise that money. But what we're looking for from your end is potentially you can provide some volunteers or a staff for a day, because you know the needs of your group. We're just getting to know this group, and we want to build a long-term relationship. So the idea is we use the agencies as a way to obviously filter our programs out to people, you know, that really want to be part of it. But at the same time, we're trying to fill that gap that was traditionally funded by government in the past.
Very good. Very good. It sounds like an exciting business model.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. Yeah, you know, it's working. You know, I think, you know, we value collaboration in this organization. It's really important. I think, you know, you see it in for-profit businesses, too. You know, they merge and to make more money, and I think in our case you sometimes have to merge your services to work with the money that's available, and you have to learn to trust each other, and you have to learn to just really look at the greater good here and take away the politics if you can. So it's hard to find those partners, but we have some really good ones.
Yeah, do they advertise that they're partners? Can we find out?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, you know, we absolutely do. Like, you know, we try to link to each of the sites that we do, and we obviously talk about our collaborative, you know, programs. I mean, I'll give you a couple of examples.
Yeah,
we currently work with Provincial Services for the Deaf or Hard of Hearing, where, you know, we help provide an outdoor education program for a few of their youth. We have a great partnership here in Victoria with the Community Living Association of Victoria. I think they're, you know, a really great organization, and we provide a lot of recreational services for their teen programs. Children's Hospital, we've been working with a group there called Balding for Dollars, and they
Balding
do a lot
for
of
Dollars?
Adventure programs for kids. Because Balding for Dollars, you shave your head.
Okay, all right. Very good.
And, you know, so it's those types of relationships that also, I think, enhance your ability to, you know, when you leverage those opportunities and you do a good job, it helps create a good name for yourself in the community.
Yeah.
What we don't want to be looked at is, you know, we're do-it-ourselves, fix-it-ourselves, because that's not what we are, and that's not who we represent ourselves as a team and a group of volunteers. It's very much about giving back and being as collaborative as possible.
Let's take an outdoor break with Ellen Shizgall of Steel Rail, Prairie Sky.
Close your eyes, and when asleep you lie, may your dreams find you under a prairie sky. Lay your head where the grass has been, under a prairie sky. While you dream, the moon will rise, where the wide open plains meet the western skies. A million stars spilled across the dark will shine in a prairie sky. Grow, your heart will be light. Close your sleep you lie, may your dreams find you under a prairie sky. Lonesome wind across your skin will whisper a
You've been listening to Tim Kermode, the founder and executive director of the Power to Be Adventure Therapy Society in Victoria, BC. Power to Be provides programs to kids as young as 8 who face challenges as diverse as cancer, autism, Down syndrome, brain injuries, abuse at home, or tough socioeconomic conditions. Programs include a day of family camping trips, snowshoeing, surfing, and sailing trips. Perhaps most surprising, they get 95% of their funding from individuals and the private sector and 5% from the federal and provincial governments. So listen up. How do you fight the urge of your partners to skew your endeavors to...
Well, you know, I don't think we fight it, you know, fight to skew. I think, you know what, we work in, you know, hand in hand to sort of look at what's the greater need in their agencies and how can we fill those gaps and vice versa, how can we support them? So, you know, if we have an internal test that gets passed and if that goes on to the next level, then we might do a couple of activities with a group just to sort of test the relationship.
Oh,
and if
yeah.
it starts to evolve, say, over a year, then we might build out, you know, a 50-day program for the youth in that program. I mean, our idea is, too, I think the other uniqueness is we really try hard not to have a little impact on a lot of people. We'd rather have a big impact on a few less. So the idea is that the agencies we work with, we want to give them a nice gap of services so that we're providing those services on a consistent basis to those families in need.
So you're talking about an ongoing relationship that basically, if it meets your requirements, can only grow.
Yeah, and I think we've got a great business model, and people are attracted to what we represent. So hopefully we can continue to expand those partners and reach out to more people in need.
Do you have corporate partners?
We do, yeah. We have a variety of corporate partners and foundations. Actually, a few ones from Toronto, the East, actually. I think about 24% of our funds roughly comes from the Toronto area.
Wow.
And largely from the larger corporations, TD Canada Trust, a major partner of ours, and a couple great foundations, the Yellow Bus Foundation, a really phenomenal foundation out of Toronto, a bunch of Bay Street individuals that got together and created a really great foundation to help sort of more grassroots organizations get started. We're very lucky in the sense that, you know, I really think you have to work with the private sector to evolve, and you have to find out what their needs are from a philanthropic standpoint and how you can, you know, recognize their efforts at the same time, you know, work together to ensure that the services that they're funding are getting met.
I'm oversimplifying it, but it sounds like a stone soup model. We have this pot, we have this water, and we put these rocks in it. What would you like to contribute?
Yeah, definitely. And, I'm no fundraising professional by any means. It's all about relationships. And I think what we do a really good job of is really trying to instill healthy relationships, keeping people informed where their money's going, letting them know the services that are happening, letting them know what our strategic plan is moving forward, getting feedback from people in the community, whether this is the right direction or not. You know, that's a lot of work, but I think that's the most important thing that really builds trust and builds relationships, and that's why it works.
And is that what you oversee basically then?
Yeah, I mean, I have a great, great team of people here. I think Power to Be's growth is largely in part because of the people that work here. You know, they're very independent in the sense that there's no sort of micromanagement in this organization. You come in and you figure out your operations plan and how you want to do your work under a certain guideline of values and how we operate. But, you know, they're very passionate people, and they drive the ship. I really, you know, we're at a point now, I used to sort of have to, you know, when you started out, I felt like I was on the board of directors, I was the treasurer, I was the financial person, I was the vision person, the fundraiser, playing all these roles.
Yeah.
And really my role has evolved to the sense that, you know, I raise money and my role is to build vision and really try to keep my hands out of the operation as much as possible, because I got a great team doing it, and that's what makes it special.
So you say you're not a fundraiser, but your job's evolved to the one where you raise money.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, like I would never, if someone asked me to be hired for another fundraising role, it would have to be something I'm really passionate about.
All right.
And I've really thought about that, and I'm really passionate about what we do, and I don't know where else that would go, kind of thing. I think I'm more passionate about creating relationships and trying to build and support businesses as much as I am about trying to support organizations. I mean, it's really great to see organizations from the private sector volunteer their time with our programs and just really engage them into the cause itself. And that's what I really love doing.
Okay. Do you employ disabled people?
You know what? So the answer is we don't turn anyone away from a disability. So in the past, we have hired people with disabilities. In fact, we had a woman that ran our program in Vancouver for 3 years. She had cerebral palsy, and then she moved on to another career. But she was, you know, obviously she was one of our best staff. And we don't, you know, I think I could say we hire the right people to be in the right places. And if it's someone who has a disability or doesn't have a disability, it doesn't matter. It just has to be the right fit. But the answer is we have hired people in the past. We have volunteers with people that are people living with disabilities. And if it's the right fit for the position, then we'll consider it.
Okay, good. To this point, you've delivered a fascinating interview. It's almost a primer in what to do to cement your place in the community and cement your values in your organization. And I've never heard a primer like that. I've heard an awful lot of cliches and best wishes and aspirational goals, you know, but I've never heard anything like what you've just given. Maybe that's too strong praise or flattery, but it is a fine guideline for other people.
I appreciate what you're saying. I think there's a lot of great organizations out there that are probably doing really similar work. I think what helps, you know, people in working in, say, the nonprofit sector, I think one of the values or one of the lucky things that we have, if you really understand this, is you can go to a lot of different business people in this community and people who are really being successful in business, and you could go ask them for advice. I think a lot of people lose sight of the idea that you're always asking for individuals for money. And it skews the relationship. But you really have to ask for advice and get them engaged and get them sharing their thoughts with you. And then take that advice seriously and do something about it. And I think the whole idea of us being a values-driven or business has come from a lot of advice from a few different individuals and a lot of case studies that we've, you know, we've we've really spent the time looking at to ensure that we're a really successful organization. And I hope we continue to be successful. I mean, you know, nothing's written in stone. I have a hard time believing in the word sustainability. I mean, I like it. I like what it stands for. But, you know, there's nothing, I think what is sustainable is your best business practice. And that's if you hire great people and you give them their ability to, you know, to really unleash their talent, and you build relationships with the core people that support you and build trust with them, you know, you can build that model of success. And I really think things can become sustainable, but, you know, nothing's written in stone when it comes to raising money. You never know where it's going to go. You just have to stay focused.
Okay. Well, yeah, if you have strong relationships underpinning it, it doesn't seem like it can go south.
We model ourselves after a couple organizations in Toronto. Camp Uchigeas, great organization. You know, they've been running camps for years for kids with cancer, and now have integrated a program into the city now, and just a really well-run machine.
Okay.
Boundless Adventures, another great program. You know, they're out of Toronto. They have a site up near Ottawa and provide services for people with brain injuries and other people with disabilities.
Okay.
Trails Youth Initiatives out of Toronto, another four-year program for at-risk kids. I mean, there's some great organizations in Toronto in Ontario doing some great things. And because of them giving us some of the successes that they've had, we've been able to do something out west here because of their help. Someone asked us, you know, does Power to Be want a franchise? And the answer is no. You know, what we want to do is if we have a model that's worked, we want to share it with other people so that they can evolve their own model in their own community and create their own values and their own needs. And I think, you know, we're already doing that with the organizations I mentioned. You know, we're on the phone talking to each other. We're sharing information. We share donors at times, you know. So it's about sharing. And I think, you know, why reinvent something that's already working? How can we enhance it to make it better? And I think the best thing we're doing is sharing ideas and coming to the table and talking about it.
Wow. Very impressive. I'm overwhelmed.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, you have a model for the instilling of your own values, the limitation of control so that your values can grow and evolve as your clients or your relationships grow and evolve. You have a talent or a mechanism for spreading the word, which is probably farthest from the mind of a commercial business.
Yeah, and I think the one thing I maybe didn't add too is, you know, every obviously NGO and you know has a board of directors to report to, and our board of directors are very passionate people too that support our cause, and they really give us the freedom to run the business the way we should run it. And you know, they stay out of the business, they work on the business, and they work on the strategy. And we're very lucky that we have a variety of skilled people on our board that have really helped us become a great organization. Because you know, another thing that can really hinder you as a non-for-profit is if you have a very unhealthy board of directors, you can anticipate you're going in a very unhealthy direction.
Yeah, that's true. So your board of directors are active overseers then, are they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, for sure. Very much so. And, you know, they helped me be a better person. My past chair in our organization was a great mentor for me. And our new chair now is another mentor for me. And we're just very lucky to have really good people that, again, bring their expertise to the table and who really, truly care. You know, they really care about what we do. They believe in what we do, and that's why they're here. They're not there because they just feel like they've been asked. They're really there to give their time and energy. And we're really lucky to have them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think your question asked me quite a while ago, you know, like sort of what do you like about working with the people with disabilities? I just get inspired by the programs and knowing that when people, you know, watching someone, you know, get out of a wheelchair and go into a kayak for the first time and that real fear of tipping or not being able to do it, and then sort of see this, you know, this fear turn to success or watching it, you know, a kid with autism and their mother letting them go for the first time into our programs, you know, very protective of their children, and to see our programs provide a place where they can be free, they don't get judged, their mothers and fathers feel trusted in the fact that we're going to provide their kids with a good service. It's a little respite for the parents.
Yeah.
To me, that's the most, that's the stuff, that's the inspiring stuff, and that's why I come to work every day.
I hope you continue to for many more years.
Too. Hopefully. If you ever come out west, we'll take you out for a kayak or something. You can count on that.
So what, Victoria, your office, head office in Victoria?
Our head office is in Victoria, and we also have an office in Vancouver. Uniglobe Travel Services provided us a really great space in Vancouver for free. and we're currently looking at some more plans to develop in Vancouver and further establish our programming here in Vancouver Island.
Fabulous, fabulous. Do you have a website address?
We do. It's www.powertobe.ca. That's powertobe.ca.
Thanks, Tim. Thank you for your time, and
thank you for telling your story.
You
know, it's always nice that we can share their stories with other listeners, and it's nice to share them with listeners in Ontario. You know, I used to live there, and I loved coming back, but I love living out west too.
Well, I used to live in BC, and it's quite a story. I would hope that other people pick up on it and establish similar organizations.
Yeah, no, for sure.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Well, all the best to you. And again, thank you so much. And look forward to hearing from you soon.
Okay. Well, we'll put this on the air this Thursday at noon.
Jeff, do you mind? Can you send me an email to the link so I can listen to it?
Okay.
You have my email, don't you?
Do you want it public?
I love it. Yeah, totally.
Oh, okay. Because I could shut the phone off if
you know, I don't mind. No, you can make it public, but I don't mind if you just send me an email too of when it shows going to go on, because I'll send it out to our donors and to our board to listen to it.
Okay, so what?
I'm sure you can listen to it online. I assume.
I'm sorry.
You can listen to it online.
Oh yes, absolutely. We're streamed around the world, and it's archived. Both at the radio station under a complicated number listening, but you can find it by the show and the date. And I list it online at a site called radioforall.net. And you can find it there under my name, the show name, Disrespect, or the actual name of the broadcast.
Okay, so if I go on there... I should be able to see that it's coming on this Thursday at 10. What time is it coming on Thursday?
Noon, my time, so 9 your time.
Okay.
But, you know, as soon as you find the CFMU site, which is HTTP, CFMU.
CFNU?
MU is in Mary.
Okay, yep.
.mcmaster.ca.
Okay, cool.
And as soon as you come up on that site, whatever is being broadcast at that time will play.
Okay,
I mean,
cool.
It's a live tap-in to the...
CFMUMcMaster.ca, and it's going to be on at 9 a.m. this Thursday.
Yeah, your time. So as soon as you tap in, if you hear my voice, the show's underway. If you hear somebody else's voice, it's ending, and my show's about to begin.
I'm looking forward to it.
There's an excellent show on before mine called Breakfast of Champions, which is a roots, blues, and... kind of a low-key comedy show. So, you know, if you hear that, you're on the right
track. I'll check it out.
Track. Okay.
Have a good one. Thanks for the call today.
Thanks, Tim.
All the best.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Tim Kermode, the founder and executive director of the Power to Be Adventure Therapy Society in Victoria, B.C. Power to Be provides programs to kids as young as 8 who face challenges as diverse as cancer, autism, Down syndrome, brain injuries, abuse at home, or tough socioeconomic conditions. Programs include a day of family camping trips, snowshoeing, surfing, and sailing trips. Perhaps most surprising, they get 95% of their funding from individuals and the private sector and 5% from the federal and provincial governments. And now it's time for Disrespect's review of the news. These are not the stories we read to you from the newspapers. These are adaptations for the radio. The newspapers and the reporters who created the stories we announced during the broadcast. Old news now, but you may have heard last Friday, the call Lucine Charles was desperately waiting for came as she stepped out of the Tropicana to Shawarma and Grill and onto the King Street West sidewalk last Friday. The voice told her she wasn't being deported, for now. At hearing this, an ecstatic Charles leaped high into the air and screamed so loud that Tangle's hair shop owner, Lori Anstett, rushed out to ask if she was all right. On seeing Charles' face, Anstett recognized her from TV that morning, so Anstett rhetorically asked if Charles had received good news. It was obvious she had. Charles' Toronto lawyer, Jackie Swaysland, had called to tell her she could stay in Canada until at least the leave to hear her case was reviewed, is decided, and if granted, until the review itself is completed by the federal court. Swaysland said the process usually takes 6 months to a year. When she arrived with her children, they were met with cheers, jubilant hugs, and joyous tears from the crowd of 200 an hour before the downtown rally her supporters had organized in front of the federal building on Bay Street. Government immigration and border officials have said Charles was being deported because she entered the country without authorization. And that story by Carmela Fragomeni in the Hamilton Spectator. Reserve school can't pay teachers. The school on Waterhen Lake, First Nation in northern Saskatchewan, is a budding success story. Standardized test scores are climbing, attendance rates are improving, and six teenagers are set to graduate this spring. But now that progress is threatened. Waterhen Lake School can't afford to pay its teachers. A new contract was signed recently in Saskatchewan, and the federal funding that the school received for salaries this winter isn't enough to match the union pay grid. Teachers are the single biggest in-school influence on student learning, studies show, and yet First Nations schools often serve as training grounds for new teachers because administrators can't afford to keep experienced staff. With a highly anticipated report from a federal Aboriginal panel on Native education expected later this month, educators are eager for help improving staff recruitment and teaching quality on reserves. That's a tall order. The gap between funding for reserve and provincial schools is growing, putting job security and union pay grids further and further out of reach. Educators on reserves are waiting to see whether the Prime Minister will back the upcoming report with more money. As much as 40% of the staff leave reserve schools each year. They work year to year on contract, and unlike the provincial system where seniority brings job security, experience can be a liability in the face of a budget crunch. It drives many of the best teachers away and leaves reserve schools with the leftovers, according to Donna Lafreniere, a teacher at Waterhen Lake with 14 years experience working on and off reserves. If I was just working for the money, I'd be gone, she said. Teaching on a First Nation, you don't have security, you don't have tenure. It makes me, as a First Nations person, feel like a second-class citizen. She said she chooses to stay because of the relationship she has built with her students. The kids need to get to know you. They need to feel you're trustworthy, she said. That stability is so important. That story by Kate Hammer, education reporter for the Globe and Mail. Action urged on child poverty. Province urged to boost child care, housing, welfare reform. Ontario's 2008 pledge to fight child poverty can't be sacrificed in the name of provincial austerity, says a new report released last Monday. Economist Don Drummond's expected call for dramatic public spending cuts drove anti-poverty activists to urge Queen's Park to help low-income families by increasing the minimum wage and making new investments in childcare, housing, and welfare reform. If the Ontario government wants to stay on track and reduce child poverty, it has to see poverty reduction as a priority, a key consideration in public sector decision-making, Ontario Campaign 2000 says in its annual report. The province's child poverty rate dropped to 14.6% in 2009, down from 15.2% a year earlier, according to Stats Can. But about 393,000 Ontario children, or one in seven, were still living in poverty, the report notes. Gains threaten to be lost if Queen's Park shifts its focus now, the report warns. Bridget Perrier, an Ojibwa from Thunder Bay who moved to Toronto 12 years ago, knows what it is like to raise her children in poverty. She often misses meals, doesn't own a winter coat, and forgoes makeup so her 18-year-old daughter in high school can afford it. But Perrier cherishes child care and affordable housing. Child care saved my life, she said, describing how it helped when she first arrived in the city with her daughter, Rose Breyer, now 12. Her tidy two-bedroom apartment in a First Nations housing development is her pride and joy. I'm moving out of poverty thanks to these kinds of support, she says, but I already see how things have gotten worse since I first came here. I worry for others. And that by Laurie Monsebraten, social justice reporter for the Toronto Star. Heartbreak City, disabled kids. Loneliness is the most terrible poverty. Quote, Mother Teresa. There are a few things more heartbreaking than a child with no friends. A new study written by Anne Snowden, a nurse and professor at the Odette School of Business at the University of Windsor in Ontario, shows that 53% of disabled kids have no friends. Outside of formal settings such as the classroom, less than 2 hours a week spent with their peers is the norm. Only 1% of children with disabilities spend an hour a day with friends. In Canada, we talk a good game about integration, about breaking down barriers to allow the inclusion of people with physical and social disabilities in every aspect of daily life, but reality is more stark and harsh. Real integration requires a lot more than building ramps, adopting human rights legislation, and funding programs. Grudging accommodation with a dash of tokenism is not enough. If we want people to be healthy, physically, mentally, emotionally, and to reach their full potential, they need to be full citizens. Kids with disabilities can't be segregated and shut out of mainstream society. They need to be like every kid, in school, in swim class, on the bus, in the playground, and hanging out at the mall with friends. That's the underlying theme of the new report, Strengthening Communities for Canadian Children with Disabilities, which Dr. Snowden presented at the annual conference of the Sandbox Project. In the report, Dr. Snowden makes three main recommendations. One, create a single online reference tool that lists all community programs, services, and professional care available to people with disabilities. Two, invest in programs where disabled kids are integrated, not segregated, so they can feel part of their community. Three, find ways to expand the social networks of children and teenagers to break the isolation. Dr. Snowden was surprised to learn from parents and children themselves that isolation was far more painful to live with than physical or developmental disabilities themselves. Sometimes we need to stop and reflect on the value of friendship, of a sense of belonging, and the value of community itself to our individual and collective health. Relationships matter more than fancy programs, but where programs do exist, they should be known and accessible, and above all, foster interaction. That by Andre Picard in the Globe and Mail. We were in touch with Dr. Snowden, but the University of Windsor's communication department intervened, and we haven't heard back from them. No surprise. Targeting drug support to the needy. Program change could help the working poor. In tough fiscal times, it probably makes sense to scrap Ontario's prescription drug program for seniors in favor of an income-tested benefit for all low-income residents. Seniors advocates and social policy experts agree. The Ontario Drug Benefit, which covered more than 4.3 million Ontarians on welfare and over age 65, last year cost almost $4.1 billion. Benefits to seniors accounted for about $2.7 billion of that. Calling that seniors' benefit, quote, very expensive, unquote, the Drummond Report suggests introducing co-payments geared to income for seniors to save between $300 million and $1 billion annually. Alternatively, the government could remove the link to age and welfare status and turn it into a benefit for all low-income Ontarians. If changing it means we can expand it to other low-income groups, not just those on welfare, would be a big improvement, said Susan Eng of CARP, an advocacy group for those over age 50. Combined with other health-related cost-saving measures in the report, it could be the first step toward a new pharmacare program for all Canadians, she added. Social policy expert John Stapleton said, this recommendation is obviously moving in the right direction. It doesn't make sense for wealthy seniors to get every cent of their drugs paid for while someone working in a poverty-level job gets no access at all. But if there are savings from the change, Stapleton said he hopes the funds would be used to extend dental benefits to low-wage workers. Currently, someone on welfare who returns to work loses the Ontario drug benefit. For an individual or family with health conditions requiring prescription drugs, losing the benefit could be a disincentive to taking a low-wage job. Although large savings would be more difficult to extract under an income-tested program available to all, the report says it should be possible to come up with a cost-neutral design. The benefit would be enhanced equity and less disincentive for those on welfare to enter the workforce, it says. said Jennifer Laidley of the Income Security Advocacy Center, in the context of low-wage work with no benefits and no job security, extending drug, dental, and vision benefits to all low-income workers is good social policy that government should pursue. However, we're not interested in having to make choices about taking it away from some people and giving it to others. That's the problem. And that by Laurie Monsabraden, social justice reporter for the Toronto Star. Generic drug supply in doubt. Multinational generic drug giant Sandoz has suspended or discontinued production of several drugs at its Quebec-based plant, following a warning from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration creating new uncertainty for Canadian patients and physicians already grappling with unexpected shortages. Sandoz Canada, which makes generic injectable drugs to treat problems such as abnormal heart rhythms and nausea in chemotherapy patients, is the leading supplier of those medications to Quebec and other parts of Canada, but it failed to clarify which products would be affected and the length of the shortages. Coming after more than a year of production problems for the industry in Canada and the United States, the slowdown is yet another blight for companies who have been accused of abandoning drugs that are no longer profitable and failing to give proper warning that pharmacy shelves will be empty when patients go to get their prescriptions filled. In the case of Sandoz Canada, the FDA conducted three separate investigations that last summer at its Boucherville, Quebec plant, following up with a warning letter on November 18th, about a year after Sandoz launched a company-wide improvement problem. The letter accused the Quebec plant, intended by the company to be a worldwide center of excellence for injectable products, of not following proper procedure to prevent contamination of sterile drug products, and said it failed to investigate crystals that appeared in the finished product of a drug sold only in the United States. The company was also criticized for not alerting the FDA to any problems quickly enough. Health Canada completed its own inspection later that month and found no issues with the company's Canadian products. The company did not respond to a request for more clarification. And that story by Aaron Anderson and Sean Silkoff in Ottawa for the Globe and Mail. Agent Orange victim denied compensation. Halifax. Relatives of a woman who died of a cancer linked to Agent Orange exposure in the 1960s say Ottawa is denying them compensation because she was diagnosed with the lethal disease 12 days after a federal deadline. Keith Haynes lost his wife, Audrey, on January 31st, just a month after the Department of Veterans Affairs issued its final ruling that she would not be eligible for the $20,000 ex gratia payment. Keith Haynes says her cancer was listed on a U.S. medical chart of illnesses the Canadian government recognizes as being linked to the spraying of Agent Orange at Canadian Forces Base Gagetown in the 1960s. But when she applied for ex gratia payment before her death, Veterans Affairs indicated she didn't qualify because she was diagnosed 12 days after the federally imposed deadline of June 30, 2011, and didn't get her application in until weeks later. Haynes, 54, and his 16-year-old daughter Jessie are fighting to have Veterans Affairs overturn its decision, arguing there should be no time frame for illnesses associated with the spray program in New Brunswick in 1966 and 67. Audrey Haynes appealed to the department, but was told repeatedly that she missed the deadline for the program, which was meant to compensate soldiers and their families who were exposed to the defoliant and later became ill. A spokeswoman with the department said she couldn't comment on the particular case, adding that each ex gratia payment was decided on a case-by-case basis. Janice Summerby said in an email about $6.6 million of the program funding was not spent by the cutoff date of December 30th. Agent Orange was part of a toxic cocktail of herbicides sprayed at CFB Gagetown in 1966 and 67 by the U.S. military with permission from Canada. It's now known that exposure can lead to skin disorders, liver problems, and some cancers. And that story in the Toronto Star by Allison Auld from the Canadian Press. Two studies refute safe pollution levels. Two separate studies released last week concluded that inhaling commonplace pollutants can trigger heart attacks or strokes. One study performed a meta-analysis of 34 previous studies. Every major component of air pollution, with the exception of ozone, was associated with an increased risk of heart attacks, according to their findings, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The second new study focused on the residents of a single American city, Boston, where the air is considered to be relatively clean. The researchers reviewed the medical records of more than 1,700 stroke patients who were treated at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center over a 10-year period. They matched the onset of stroke symptoms in each patient to hourly air pollution measurements collected at the nearby environmental monitoring station of the Harvard School of Public Health. We found that the risk of stroke was about 35% higher on days when the air quality was classified as moderate compared to good days with lower pollution levels, said the lead researcher, Gregory Wallenius at Brown University. If future research confirms the findings from these new studies, public health officials may need to revise their pollution standards, said Dr. Wallenius. That could mean tougher measures to curb pollution. Plus, people with cardiovascular disease and lung ailments may be urged to avoid prolonged exposure outdoors on more days of the year. That article by Paul Taylor at the Globe and Mail. Seniors forced to choose between pets and housing. Taking animals away is cruel, New Brunswick NDP leader says. New Brunswick's Social Development Department has threatened to evict seniors living in Moncton's Lions Tower if they don't give up their pets. The emotional fallout has New Democrat MP and provincial leader Dominic Carty calling for the province's progressive conservative government to adopt something like the Ontario Residential Tenancies Act, which states no renter can be discriminated against for having a pet and that any provision in a lease preventing pets is void. In order to remove the pet, the landlord must prove a pet is causing damage, interfering with the enjoyment of the landlord or the other tenants, is dangerous, or perhaps causing an allergic reaction to the other tenants or the landlord. Carty said his party has urged Social Development Minister Sue Stultz to reverse the eviction order and adopt the Ontario law for all renters. Carty said that it's been proven time and time again that having a pet helps reduce symptoms, tension, anxiety, depression, and feelings of isolation. In many cases, these pets are a senior citizen's only real companion, he said, adding that one woman had her cat for 4 years before being forced to give it up. Ministry spokeswoman Judy Cole told the Star the no-pet rule has been around for 25 years and that when people sign the rental agreement for low-income housing, they know they cannot bring their pets. Agnes Mitchell, 67, got her eviction notice January 30th and has become a poster person for the campaign against the rule on pets. She had her cat for 4 years and says it never left her apartment. When I first came in this apartment in 2001, I didn't know nothing about the no pets rule. It was in the lease, but I didn't read the lease. I was so glad just to get a place to stay, said Mitchell, who says she came from an abusive relationship. When told that other people had complained about the cats urinating in the building, Mitchell said if there was anybody peeing in the halls, it would be a human. Mitchell and others are trying to gather names on a petition, which they hope to present to the New Brunswick legislature. That story in the Toronto Star by Richard J. Brennan, national affairs writer. Online surveillance bill opens privacy fears. Ottawa. Justice Minister Rob Nicholson says legislation that would give police and spies easier access to information about internet users is simply an attempt to bring the law into the 21st century. He rejects NDP warnings that the bill threatens to turn Canada into a surveillance society. He said the new bill, tabled Tuesday, February 14th, strikes a balance between giving the police new tools and protecting privacy rights. It would also require telecommunication service providers to have the technical capability to allow authorities to intercept messages and conversations. The NDP says the bill opens the door to snooping and police fishing expeditions. The bill would allow authorities access to internet subscriber information, including name, address, telephone number, and email address without first getting a court's go-ahead. Privacy Commissioner Jennifer Stoddart and her provincial and territorial counterparts have publicly expressed concerns about a previous, similar incarnation of the legislation that died on the order paper. And that from the Canadian Press. No attribution. That's all the news we have this week at Disrespect. But come back next week. We will have more. And to take us out, an instrumental from Steel Rail, Wild Rose. This is Jeff Langhorne of Disrespect Radio. I think you're here instead of listening to commercial radio because you want to. Well, something funny, I'm here because I want to, too. All our hosts on community radio are unpaid volunteers. Our management takes less than scale, so they must want to, too. Our guests, they have to want to as well. They're not looking for the big endorsement. They're not looking for big bucks. They're here because they want to talk to you, the CFMU listener. We're simulcast around the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're also podcast back 6 or 7 years at this time. We're archived at radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can reach the show at disrespect@lycos.com. Come back at showtime next week on CFMU 93.3 on your radio at 12 noon on Thursdays. You know you want to.